rested, almost 39.
Shavua Tov, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the continuation of this ongoing series on the Aguna crisis. The topic for this evening is prenuptial agreements. You received copies of the first two pages of a prenuptial agreement.
Back and front.
Front and back. Now, this is not the full text that you received on your email, but it will satisfy our need for discussion for this evening. If you want to actually sign one, go on the on your link that you received in the email, you'll get a four-page document. The first two are identical in text to what you received.
Sign one after you got married?
To what you received in hand, except it has a place for the signatures and on the bottom. The two other pages, one is a notarization page and one is an instruction page, which again you don't have in front of you. You can easily get it if you just go on and get the link. Okay, let us begin. Yes, Michael.
You want to ask the obvious question about how not you're married?
Post-nuptial agreements. Yes, this is a prenuptial agreement. Post-nuptial agreements are possible. They have various, both halachic and legal complications that prenups don't have, and they will not be discussed this evening. If you have questions, you can talk to me about it afterwards. For those who are historically inclined, here in our own community in Riverdale, some 20 years ago, approximately, there was a get-together where post-nups were signed. My wife and I signed one. It's hidden away somewhere in a drawer. That's where all good pre-nups and post-nups should be hidden. I'm sorry? Well, that's where it's hidden. Shh. No one knows that is, though. Husband shouldn't know where the ksuba, shouldn't know where this is. It's all hidden away.
I have my ksuba on the wall. I should hang it
up. All right. Okay. If you know anyone who is filling out a prenup, but seriously speaking, please make sure that a copy is given to the Bezdin. Because the Bezdin will not lose it. You can lose anything. The Bezdin keeps good records. Okay, let's get started. History. Go back to the history of this prenup, how it started. It all started, goes back to 1990, when the yeshiva was learning Gittin. And it was a particular case in the community. We're not going into that right now. So I felt after Pesach, instead of learning another Lamdash Shtikl Torah, where the Torah is Gittin, and another, well, let's try to tackle this problem, because it was a real problem here, right over here in front of me. And in doing so, I looked at the most recent developments, because there was new things, and I saw a whole series of suggestions that should have been made by others, and I don't want to go into the other suggestions, because I found them all problematic. But I did see something which is printed in a Torah journal 2 years previous, it was 1988, by someone named Rabbi Zalman Nechemya Goldberg. And it was in an article written by a man named Rabbi Tzvi Gartner. So, I really didn't know who, I was just a babe in the woods, I didn't know exactly what's going on. I found out that Rabbi Zalman Nechemya Goldberg is one of the Gedolei Hador, who's the son-in-law of Shlomo Zalman. And Rabbi Tzvi Gartner, I found out, is an American who lives in Yerushalayim. And there's also a tremendous Talmud Chacham who's expert in this field. Okay. So, I received an introduction from one of our someone who I knew from the yeshiva, and I called up Rabbi Goldberg and asked him, has his suggestion been implemented to the best of his knowledge? And he gives a suggestion, is it the Maisa? Is anyone using it? So he didn't know. I spoke to this Rabbi Gartner, who was an American, he didn't know. I said, well, let's go, let's do it. So that's how it started. Of course, there were certain kinks and certain modifications had to be made. So starting from then, it was the spring of 1990. I called Rav Zalman Nechemya, and we wrote back and forth to each other. And after a while, it became clear if I don't come see him in person, it's not gonna work. So I went that winter. I mean, between the two terms, there's a break in January. So it's now the anniversary. It was the beginning of January. The year was 1991. Those who know a little about American history.
Gulf War.
Exactly. Gulf War. First Gulf War. As a matter of the entire drama took place under the shadow of the first Gulf War. I landed just shortly before, and I went quickly to see Rav Zalman Nechemi right away. And he said, you know, I think it's right, but you can't base a new initiative for the whole world on one person. Can't do it. You have to go ask someone else. I said, who should I ask? Go to Rav Tzimba List. He is a wonderful dayan in the Bezin in Tel Aviv, and see what he says. Okay? Rav Tzimba List, turns out, is married to an American. And I called him up. I said, yeah, come meet me at the Bezin. I met him in the Bezin in Tel Aviv. And I had a car. I drove him to his house. We sit down. I show him. No, he doesn't think this is not the right way to phrase it. Got to phrase it a different way. I said to myself, I've been working on this since after Pesach. Now it's already, we're holding by almost Rosh Chodesh Shvat. I mean, we're talking about the 3/4 of a year. And then I'm toast. All for naught. I traveled so many miles for nothing. Because Rav Zalman Nechemia has his way. And Rav Tzimbalist has his way. And that's it. It's over. That was my thinking. I was a bit despondent. Okay. I came back to Yerushalayim. And I went again to see Rav Zalman Nechemia. I was afraid, you know what he'd say? You know what? He said, we'll do it his way. B'mokom gedulaso shomatamotze invesanusa. The place where you see a man's greatness, that's where you see his humility. Here he has, he's printed. This is already now, it's almost 3 years since his printed suggestion was on record. And in a flash, he said, okay. First he said, you can't rely on me, go ask someone else. And when the someone else suggests something else, he said, okay, do it his way. Just like that. Okay, so now we had to get his way and you know, fix it up. You can't just, you know, he gave me a suggestion. And, you know, this went back and forth. You know, I was only there for under 2 weeks. You know, I came on a Sunday. I was due to leave the Thursday night. I was there for 11 days. And, you know, another day. That Shabbos, you have to tell a little personal story. That Shabbos I spent in Yeshiva at Keren B'Yavneh, because my boys, Rafael and Moshe, were Talmidim there at the time. There was a lot of tension because the Gulf War was heating up, and as you may remember, it was a January 15th deadline. Remember, that was the date that they gave you. Saddam, you don't do that, we're going to... And it was quickly moving up on us. I still remember the days of that week. Monday, I speak personally, you know, I was, although I wasn't officially sent by the yeshiva, but, you know, I had Talmidim and all the various yeshivas we were close with, so I went to visit. I was in Karabiyad of Shabbos. I was in Shalavim, and I was also in Gush. So that day, I went to meet with my two boys. We went to meet in front of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein Shalita's house. He had a refuah. He fell. He has a refuah. In front of his house, Rav Amital Zichrono Livracha comes in his car, picks us up. Rav Aaron's in the front, and myself and my two sons are sitting in the back. We're talking about this and that. It was fascinating. It was part of the discussion. When we finished Bashir and came back, we took a bus. We went straight to the coastal of Maravi, where because it was Shovavim, and by the Hasidim, they have Shovavim on Monday and Thursday. It's a big deal. There were apparently 80,000 people at the coastal of Maravi to pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that we should spare from the chemical weapons that we were threatened with just a few days later. Tremendous crowd. Mincha was, huge. Okay. So, meanwhile, I'm here for a job. I didn't come just to down by the coastal. I came to work it back and forth at the prenup, and the days are ticking. So the next day, this is history. The next day was Tuesday, was Erev Rosh Chodesh Shvat. It was Yom Kippur Kotten. It was for the first time in my life, I believe, I fasted Yom Kippur Kotten. I'm not a big fan of fasting. It's not my thing. But they said, you know, the chemical weapons. Yeah, the Rabbanut said, you had to fast. So we fasted there. Another thing about the coastal, you may recall that evening, the what they called Operation Torah Shield. There was an airplane came with 400 young men and women, mostly from our yeshiva, came to show solidarity with Eretz Yisrael. Everyone's leaving, and they're coming. Rabbi Shechter was on the plane. Many, many, many people were on the plane. So it was I felt I have to go be mekabel panim. So I went, remember, I was fasting. The plane landed that afternoon. And I went in a bus. We got on a bus, which took us to the airport. And, we met them. From there, I went straight with a bus to Tel Aviv to Rav Tzimbalist's house. Right? He knew how to get there. And he would have to give his final approval of the text, which he did. This is now Tuesday night. Okay, Tuesday night. I think the 15th, look up on your calendars. You have your calendar on your, I think, what day was the 15th that year, January 9th? I think it was Wednesday, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't know. So, we came on the 17th when they started with the discussion.
That was Friday?
We were flying out. No.
Thursday. So maybe the 15th was Tuesday. But it was around, it was one of those days, it was the 15th. The kids in there, I come to Yerushalayim, and the place is deserted. There's nobody there. Okay. Now to go back up to Zalman Nechemi. So I called him up. I'm too busy. I'm saying shirim all over them. The only way you can see me, if you come to meet the Shalavim, come to the Shalavim, you can talk to me in the car there, in the car back. He says, shir Wednesday night. Got Wednesday night. And the final document was written on a back of a piece of paper on an envelope. And this is it. Done. Now ready. Good. I'll leave out the other war stories for another time. So the kids, I come back home. Time for Shabbos. Just came out before the Scuds. Okay, not for that. So then I go to my team. My team, there's a distinguished member of the team, is sitting right in the back of this room. The lawyers, because if you don't have it, it's not legally enforceable. You can have all the chachamim in the world behind it. It's not going to accomplish anything. But the whole legal team, back and forth, how to phrase this, how to phrase that. Make sure it's going to be enforceable in New York State. Ta-da, back. Let me tell you, it took a whole another year. Things don't move in 1 minute.
The lawyers get paid a lot of money.
The lawyers all did it pro bono. No one got paid a penny for this, to the best of my knowledge. All pro bono. The kids are after a year. So I'm ready to go. Now I need the final approval of all the rabbanim. I had to go back again to Eretz Yisrael. This is a year later. And I come and typed out a text and a typewriter someone was down in Harnof near my where my in-laws were. And I bring it to Rav Zalman Nechem. He signs his name. Go to Tel Aviv, Rav Tzimbalist, he signs his name. I went to Rav Avadi Yosef, and he signed his name. He had the wisdom to naturally sign his name and say, I need my skin, and he put a date on it. That's very important. Well, the history, it could be even Rosh Chodesh Shvat, Tov Shin Nun Beis. This is January 1992. Came back, got to high gear with the lawyers, and we put something out, not that much different than what you have in front of you. Not exactly the same, certain changes since then. We had a text, and we're ready to go. Let's go. Fill it out. So what is it? After this historical background, which is important, because you have to see where things come from, what is it? It turns out that the fundamental thrust of this text is really not so new. People complain about doing something new. It's not so new. It's really found in Nachlas Shiva Simon Tess. Nachlas Shiva is the Bible of all documents that were used in Europe, written by a student of the Taz in the 17th century. And if you look into what's called the Tanoim Achronim, you have something which reads as follows, that the man agrees that if he does something that his wife can no longer be with him, that they're going to go to within a bezin within 2 weeks, and he's going to immediately pay his wife 10 zehuvim, and every month he's going to give her 10 zehuvim until, they say euphemistically, the bezin can put everybody back together again. Now, I think it's a euphemism. Others disagree with me, but that's what it says. So therefore, the guts, if you will, of this document is the italicized section on page 2, with which we're going to begin this evening. I hereby now, you see it's indented and in italics. Me'achshav. Me'achshav is a Hebrew word, of course, from now on, which is a term of art. It is intended to avoid certain halachic problems of obligating for later on after the vessel is returned and to overcome a problem which is called asmachta, which we'll get to. Obligate myself to support my wife to be from the day that our domestic residence together shall cease for whatever reasons at the rate of $150 per day. Now, there's a history behind this too. Rav Zalman Nechemi wrote $50 a day. And how did he arrive at that figure? That's what it cost to stay in a hotel with full room and board in 1988. I'm not sure what hotel he meant. I don't even think the central hotel in Yerushalayim you can get that price at that time. But certainly not in this country. But anyway, so it was immediately moved to 100. Initially, when we started 20 years ago. And it moved to 150 10 years ago when people did inflation. It wasn't enough. Even this number is indexed to CPI, because otherwise you don't know what's going to be in the future. In lieu of my Jewish law obligation of support. Stop right here. Is there a Jewish law obligation of support? Or is there not? That's the question. Forget a prenup. Let's say there is no prenup. It's very short. We're going to read Sheira, Ksusav, and also Lo Yigra.
But also in the Ksuba, right?
Also in the Ksuba, correct. However, the question becomes, does this obligation apply in a situation in which the husband and wife are no longer living together? They're no longer under the same roof. Does this obligation continue to exist, or does it not? So, black letter law. Black letter law. I'm going to read you from a Shulchan Aruch. Eben Ezer Simen Ayin, Sif Yud Beis. Ha'isha sheyota mi beis bala v'hocha l'bayas achim. Woman left her husband's home and went somewhere else. The equivalent is she threw him out of the home. So it's all the same thing. They're not living in the same under the same roof. Oh, slow. In bo machmas tana she b'shchuna she otziel le hashem ra v'chayotze b'zeh. In other words, it's not her fault that she had no choice but to leave. Chayav lezuna in tovim mezonos. He has to pay for her support, even in another place, if she asks for support. Okay, fine. That's what it says. Good. Now, what happens? Im hoysalok toto imbalo. A fight with a husband. Velo mizdala imo. And they can't live together. Vahamaniya mimenu. And it's his fault. Sarach l'shal. Black letter law. If it's his fault, he has to pay. Aval hamaniya mimenu. If it's her fault, eino tzorach l'shalim. The eino ish chayvim zonos ishto. So it's clear, black letter law. It all depends whose fault it is. So at first glance, it's simple. No problem, black letter law.
It's always the other guy's
fault. It's always. The problem with this black letter law is, and that's the problem, one of the rabbanim said, what's the problem? Just translate the ksuba, put it in English, make it legally binding, and that's it. He's bound by the ksuba. Oh no. He will come and say, it's her fault. She'll say, of course, it's his fault. And when and how will that be adjudicated? Like we have today. I want to go to this bezin, I want to go to court, I want to go here. As we say, she'll turn white until the adjudication will take place. In the interim, she cannot remarry, he cannot remarry, it's a disaster. All this document does is close that hole. This document closes that hole. If you look very carefully in the part that we just read, in the italicized section. Okay. It explains, for whatever reasons. Okay. Shall cease for, we just read it, for whatever reasons. In other words, what he's saying is that even though, according to black letter law, I can say I'm not going to pay her a penny because the breakup is her fault, but after he signs this piece of paper, he can no longer say that because if they're no longer living together, for whatever reasons, this obligation exists.
Reverend,
yes.
Why do you have to say the words in lieu of? Whether or not he owes her money by the Shulchan Aruch law is debatable, but you can just agree to pay her that money. It doesn't have to be in lieu of anything. You agree to pay her a certain amount of money. Well, as soon as they stop living together,
that is true. And what will happen?
There'll be a separate.
Oh, right. So she'll say, I want $150 a day. Plus, I want more money because you owe me under Jewish law.
So
we take care of that by saying, that cannot be done. It's in lieu. So
you're really taking away money from her.
In theory, that's correct. In theory, this takes away money from a woman. Because a woman is entitled to be supported at the rate which is the higher of the two standards of living. Called Olo Imo, Veni Oredes Imo. So in theory, this can take away. But the problem is, what that takes away from is not collectible in real life. This is collectible in real life. That's the difference. This you can go into court and collect it.
Well,
other one you can't.
Just
This way we want to be fair to everybody. This is how it says. Fine. As long as the two of us remain married according to Jewish law, now here's another problem. Another problem is, this is a important point. It says in Shulchan Aruch that a man can say to his wife, listen, tell his wife as well, listen. There's a quid pro quo in halach. I have to support you, but your earnings belong to me. Now, let's do a little bit of arithmetic. Right. Even $150 a day, what does that come to for a year? We have some number of crunchers over here. $50,000+, right? And that's what it comes out to. The woman is an attorney, she's a physician, whatever she's doing, whatever. She's making twice that. So say to her, I'm happy to give you the $50,000. You give me $100. No problem. So then what have we gained? So it says over here, look carefully, if she has another source of income or earnings, he can't exempt himself on the ground that she can support herself. And more than that, furthermore, I waive my halachic right to my wife's earnings for the period that she is entitled to the above stipulated sum. Because otherwise, he'll give her 50 and take back 100. And I recite, I'll tell you what this is all about, that I shall be deemed to have repeated this waiver at the time of our wedding. What's that all about? There's the Mishnah in Ksubas and Afpe Gimel, which seems to tell us that all these kinds of waivers can only transpire in a brief window of opportunity. After the Erisin, which is the first stage of marriage, what's called betrothal sometimes, and the Nisuin, the final portion of marriage.
Nowadays, this is 5 minutes.
Okay, but in those 5 minutes, you can do a lot.
Yeah,
when my father, Zichron Levracha, remarried, so Rav Nissim Karelitz gave on a piece of paper for him to say a certain text after the ring was put on her finger and before the Sheva Brachos. And the piece of paper said, as per the Gemara in Ksubas Pegimim, Dinu Dvarim, Ein li ben chosayach of a perosein of a perosein ad olam, which meant, simply, that his second wife wanted to maintain the property that she had for the benefit of her own children, which is logical, because they have to, by Din Torah, a husband inherits his wife if she predeceases. So the way to avoid that is by saying it during that window of opportunity, not before, not after. This should also be done, in theory, at that point. The only one I know in the world who ever did it was Rav Aaron Lichtenstein Shalita. Again, should have a refuah. Rav Aaron once had a prenup. He contracted it under the chuppah after the ring was given because he wanted to avoid this problem. We try to avoid it by saying, I recite that I shall be deemed to have repeated this way by the time of the wedding, which is, to be honest, somewhat questionable. However, in my opinion, the whole thing is not really necessary for the following reason. If you look in the Shulchan Aruch, where it tells us what the husband is entitled to. The husband is entitled to Masi Adel Abala Ketzad. It says over here, Akol Kiminik HaMedina, what she normally does, she knits a certain amount of knitting that she is that he is entitled to. However, what happens if she goes beyond the normal, she does more than is normally done. What happens then? Is he entitled to that? The question, what happens to that extra stuff? Right? What happens? So that's a question. Does it go to the husband or does that stay with her? The question, hold on. This is a dispute. She can say, it belongs to me. Now, many poskim say that even this dispute is limited to a woman who's knitting. But instead of knitting X amount, she's very quick and talented, she knits Y amount. But what if she's a doctor or a lawyer and she's working crazy hours? Forget it. There's no way that belongs to the husband. That's how most poskim assume. So therefore, this, although there is some weakness in this sentence, in all likelihood, you don't need it in the first place because she's making a large sums of money. It belongs to her in any event. Just want to give you full disclosure. Okay? Now, there's a problem known as asmachta. Asmachta means a conditional obligation, particularly if it's an exaggerated obligation. We believe this obligation is not exaggerated. It's $150 a day. Some people say it's too little. But okay, whatever it may be, figure out how much you have to cost to live. You can all figure out yourself. What does it cost to live? One person. Nothing to do with children. One person. So what do you have? You have to pay rent. Right? You have to pay for food. You have to pay for clothing. That could be insurance. A car, if where that's required. And then if you, it adds up.
Tuition?
No. This is just for the woman herself. It adds up. I don't think this is an exaggeration at all. And the post can say a slight exaggeration is also okay. For reasons I can't go into right now, I'll show you in a few minutes. Anyway, but one of the ways to overcome the asmachta problem is what's called a kinyan sudar bebezdin choshev. That's this next line. I acknowledge that I have now me'achshav effected the above obligation by means of a kinyan, formal Jewish transaction, and an esteemed choshev bezdin as prescribed by Jewish law. Mind you, this need not be done. This need not be done. All you require is an admission that you did it. Because in Jewish law, there's a famous principle known as Hodas Baal Din Kemeya Eidim Dami. If you admit that you did something, then it's halakhically considered as if you did it and you're fully responsible. This is this last sentence over here. Fine? Now, what will happen? A woman will take advantage. She doesn't want to get remarried. She just wants to be supportive for the rest of her life. It's not fair. Read further. However, this support obligation shall terminate if wife-to-be refuses to appear upon due notice for the Bezdin of America, or in the event that wife-to-be fails to abide by the decision or recommendation of the Bezdin of America. Now, there are some individuals who are very critical of this line. They say, wait a minute, this puts everything in the hands of a Bezdin. The woman wants to be able to collect the sum unconditionally. That's very nice from their perspective. But the Rabbanim who gave me the permission, if you will, to go forward with this, insisted, we have a Bezdin system. You can't just go around the Bezdin system. You can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't expect that you get $150 a day and completely ignore whatever Bezdin says or decides or recommends. You can't have your cake, you can't have both. So therefore, this is a very important sentence, to, in effect, to protect the husband and protect the Bezdin system. So some naysayers, critics of this prenup, say, wait a minute, the prenup is no good. Why is it no good? Because the woman wants to be able to take whatever she can get from her husband in secular court, and that could be very considerable, and at the same time, come back and ask for $150 a day so that she can have a better chance of receiving a get. And this sentence says no. Because unless the Bezdin decides or recommends that she may go to secular court, which is unlikely, then not. She has to go to the Bezdin for a full judgment, and then they can give her this $150 a day. The answer to these critics is, you're right. Your criticism is absolutely correct. This is not meant to give a woman the ability to take money which she's not entitled to with Jewish law from a husband in court on the one hand, and still be entitled to this on the other hand. You're right. If you consider that to be a shortcoming, so be it. I plead guilty. Yes?
What about the fact that you named a specific Bezdin?
If you don't name the Bezdin, what happens is, unfortunately, it's just fights. In our initial draft, we left the amount of money blank. We left the Bezdin blank. On the grounds that that's the more liberal. We realized all of those causing was fights. How much money was a fight? Which Bezdin was a fight? We put a standard. You can change it. Everyone has a computer. You want to put in the Bezdin of Satmar instead. Whatever you want to do, you can do. You want to put $100 or $200, you can do that too.
Okay, but because somebody mentioned to me before the shiur that the Agoda Fritz is not happy with this document.
Let me address that in a few moments. I will address the critics as well, because it's important. There are critics, some of whom are more distinguished than others. And I don't like to, you know, I like to be transparent and to tell you the critics' point of view as well, and to try to respond to some of the criticism. I'll try to do that in a few moments. Yes, sir?
So if this document is to try to help get a woman a get, to push that along, and the husband is difficult, and he's making $500,000 a year, $50,000 a year doesn't mean anything.
You're 100% correct. Another criticism. This is nothing. A guy's a multimillionaire, $50,000 bucks. It's not. It's like a nickel. It's a small change. A, you're right. B, even a multimillionaire does not want to give any money to some woman that he now hates.
But he'd rather do that than give a gift.
Sometimes, yes, you're right. You're right. A much bigger shortcoming is the man has zero money. We call him then judgment proof. He'll say, yeah, I owe you $50,000 a year. Ainley. That's a bigger problem. What are you doing? There are more people who are broke than are multimillionaires.
Right, but if they're broke, they can't use that as, you know, as a tool. To
not a tool. They're just broke. So you can, they'll say, I owe you the money, but that's not real. The multimillionaire, I've learned that multimillionaires don't have to give up any money, even a nickel. That's how they became multimillionaires in the first place. That's what I've learned about them. But not for now. Okay. But your point is very well taken. Absolutely correct. And I'm the first to say this is not... The problem with percentages and things of this nature is the more detailed you get, the more complex it is, and people are going to fight about it and not going to sign it. We try to make it as simple as possible, which covers most of the cases. An individual who wishes to put in a higher number, a woman's marrying a multimillionaire, $150, that's not enough. Like you said before, it's not enough. You're a multimillionaire. Put in $500, that's it.
Yeah.
That's okay for that multimillionaire.
Prenups outside of the halachic prenups.
They're financial
prenups. All the wealthy people on it, sometimes on the first marriage, sometimes on the fifth or sixth, they take care of his problem over there. You know,
right.
You can tie it only to 50 million or 100 million.
Right, that's true. That's true.
So can you amend this and add one of those prenups to it?
This is not a financial prenup. We'll call it a bezin prenup. There are ways to merge this with a financial prenup. The one who's the biggest expert on that merger is Rabbi Yonah Reis Shalita, who's now the Abbezin in Chicago, formerly a neighbor of us, right over here in Riverdale. Because he has a law degree from Yale, and he's involved in the Bezdin, he'll know exactly how to put together a financial prenup and this in the best way. I know I have no law degree, so I know my limitations, so therefore I would not even attempt. Yeah, financial prenup by definition is going to go to secular court because that's how they did it.
That now, doesn't get you a get, though.
No, that won't get you anything. That won't help you in this respect. Now, here's another question. The next part of this paragraph is, I'll tell you a fascinating historical case. Case happened in Maryland, in which a couple were divorced. They were getting divorced, and there was a prenup. And they came to our bezdin to adjudicate their whatever disputes that they had. And the man was very forthcoming. Right away came to the bezdin as soon as he was summoned. Says, well, I'm able to give the get whenever you want. Okay? As soon as he was summoned, it took, till he was summoned, it took a little bit of time. It took whatever it was, a few months. He summoned, I'll give the get whenever you want. She said, well, I'm not ready to take it yet because we still have some outstanding matters in the secular court, and they had opted to have their secular matters decided, this financial matters decided in the secular court, which is probably against halacha, but neither here nor there. And so it took a couple of years. No one was in a rush, apparently. After 3 years, finally, the secular decision is reached, and the get is given right away. He gets a letter in the mail the next week. $100,000. It was then only $100 a day. I won $100,000 for 3 years of support. I said, what? I wasn't recalcitrant. I was cooperative from the first minute. What is this? So they came to the Bezin. And the Bezin came to a decision that she's entitled to $10,000. Now, it wasn't just a 10 cents on the dollar kind of a compromise. No. They said she's entitled to the money until he came to Bezin and said, I'm ready to give the get today. Then she didn't want to take it anymore. But the first 3 months, even though, you know, there was no recalcitrance, but the bottom line is that he was required to support her. So that, they both appealed. We have an appeal system in our Bezin. She appealed, I want $100,000. He appealed, I don't owe a penny. Now, in theory, any appeal has to go to the Av Bezin, that's Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz in Chicago, or his designee. So in this case, his designee was yours truly. I was a designee to decide on this case. I worked very hard on it, and I consulted, of course, and I wrote a decision. And the result of my decision was, and I explained it at significant length, decision is actually, I think, printed somewhere in the publication later from our Beis Din. And my decision was that she's entitled to
nothing.
Zero. Zero. Okay. So she was very, very upset about that. And she threw away $10,000. Right? Although, I don't know, he appealed anyways. It doesn't matter. She took it to the secular court. And she wanted to have my decision overturned. But you can't overturn an arbitration agreement unless the decision is irrational. Either corrupt, she took bribes, they didn't accuse me of that. It was an irrational decision. That's what the claim was made. The judge in Maryland says, and this is on, you can see it's public information, to the contrary. It's a very rational and well-reasoned decision. I like this decision. I took a compliment from the judge. This is good. This makes a lot of sense. So, this is what happened. But you know what is happening every single time? It's ridiculous. So this is what we added. Some of the language was there from before. Some was added even afterwards. Furthermore, wife-to-be waives her right to collect any portion of the support obligation attributable to the period preceding the date of her reasonable attempt to provide written notification to husband-to-be that she intends to collect the above sum. Said written notification must include wife-to-be notarized signature. Okay? Period. And it says, this support obligation under Jewish law is independent of any civil or state law obligation for spousal support or any civil or state imposed order for spousal support and shall be determined only by the Beis Din of America. In other words, it's independent. Now, it's best to be careful. The Beis Din can make this a determination that if the state compels the man to give X dollars per month or year to his wife, that satisfies his obligation. Or the Beis Din can say no. It's all in the hands of the Beis Din. That's the way it should be. Let the Beis Din decide on every case-by-case basis what they will do in every single situation.
But the secular court will say he has to give X amount of dollars to his wife, and she'll go get a civil divorce, and then that agreement is known, is over.
We are not telling the civil law, we cannot tell the civil court what to do.
But
they can't tell us what to do either. So that's why we can either say that whatever's in here will be over and above whatever she gets in civil law, because maybe we don't think it's enough. Or we may say no. But that's all in the hands of the Beis Din, and here's the case. That's that we want to be independent. That's why this language was added. This is the guts of the agreement. This is the guts, the italicized part. The rest is, as we'll call on this page, is boilerplate. You can read it at your leisure. Some of the attorneys, one of them who's in the room, helped work under some of this language. We call it boilerplate. It's what the lawyers, have proper language. And by the way, it's not necessarily so diverse. We're still willing to change things even to this day. You want to make an improvement, which will make things better, just let me know. We'll pass it by the lawyers, and if they approve, we can make further improvements. This is, just be careful to know it's not etched in stone. Atkan, page 2. Okay. Before I get to the objection, I want to just read quickly page 1. It's a very short page 1, but we'll see it toward the bottom of some significance. The top is just, again, boilerplate. The place, the date, the names, the addresses. They're going to come to the Beis Din of America. And the parties agree that the Beis Din has exclusive jurisdiction to decide all issues related to a get, as well as any issues arising from this agreement, or the ksuba and tanoim, entered into by the husband-to-be and wife-to-be. Each of the parties agrees to appear in prison for the Beis Din of America at the tender of the other party. This is the beginning. Now, this is the question. Very often, if a couple breaks up, there are other issues. Aside from the ksuba, the tanoim, what is that? Financial issues. There could be custody issues, support. All these things can exist. Who will decide this? And by what rules or regulations will it be decided? So we determined that there were women who did not want to sign on to any document which put everything in the hands of the Beis Din. They didn't want to. So we were left with a dilemma. We can't officially approve of any individual going to a secular court when it says Ve'ela Mishpatim Ashatasim Lefneim V'lo Lefnei Ovel Kachavim. On the other hand, there were some women who wouldn't sign otherwise. So the decision was taken that whether additional matters will be placed in the jurisdiction of the Beis Din or not should be optional. Not only is it optional, as we shall see, there were women who were willing to put everything in the hands of the Bezdin, but not if the Bezdin is going to decide by black letter Jewish law, because they are coming from a society where they're used to doing things in a different way. For example, in New York State, there is something called equitable distribution, which means that the judge decides what's fair. Now, how he decides that is a complicated parsha. I'm not going to that now. She put him through medical school, you know, all kinds of cheshbonos, which I'm not going to go into. In California, don't bother me. 50-50, it's called community property. That's it. It saves a lot of time. 50-50, finished. That's called community property. A couple may come and they say, listen, rabbis, we're happy that the Bezdin should hear the case. Could we trust the Bezdin? I don't know, Bezdin is, you know, in many, many ways superior to secular court. I'm not going to go into all the many ways. But we'd like that the Bezdin should take into account the system that we're used to. We have a halachic opinion of Zalman Lechem Yigov. There's nothing wrong with that. And that's why these options exist. You look on the three options, one side by side. The first one, that the parties give the Bezdin the authority to decide all monetary disputes, division of property and maintenance, period. That means they'll decide according to strict halacha. You know, halacha itself is pretty has a lot of latitude, but halacha only. The second, the middle one, it says, based on principles, equal distribution law customarily employed in the United States and found in the Uniform Marriage and Divorce Act. This is not the law in any state of the 50 states of the Union. We did this. Some people said if you have a state of the law of a particular state, it's considered our cause or the Fnehem. I don't think it's correct. But just to satisfy those critics, we didn't trade New York State. We gave equal distribution looking at some code, which is not, in fact, law in any of the states. And the third one is community property law, again, not based on California, but based on the Uniform Marriage and Divorce Act. So they can sign any one of these three. If they sign none of them, then what happens? Then the financials, the Bezdin has no jurisdiction to hear it. Does that mean the Bezdin is giving permission for it to be given to a different, to a secular court, chas v'shal? Just the parties didn't agree to have it heard in front of our Bezdin. So in theory, it should go to a different Bezdin. Or maybe they'll decide later to come to our Bezdin. Be very careful. The last line is, again, the most vulnerable, to be full disclosure. The parties agree that the Bezdin of America is authorized to decide all disputes, including child custody, child support, and visitation matters, as well as any other disputes that may arise between them. The problem is that strictly these issues, child custody, child support, and visitation, are the sole prerogative of the state court, which considers themselves the responsible party for children, and therefore it's not given over to arbitration. Money issues between the husband and the wife, or any other people for that matter, business partners, can be given over to arbitration, and again, except for this charge of corruption, bribery, or irrational decisions, it stands. This last line, if it's signed by the parties, and I tell everyone to sign it, cannot automatically stand. Any judge on a whim could decide this decision about custody, visitation, support is not given over to arbitration. I strike it down for no reason other than I don't want it. I strike it down like this. However, history. This is going on for 20 years plus. History. None of our decisions has ever been struck down by any judge for the following reason. We, in our Bezdin, have probably something unique. Other Bezdins don't do it. We put a psychologist on the Bezdin, not just as a consultant. The consultant, you know, on the Bezdin. I sat on the case, probably the first case on our Bezdin way, way back, and I sat with another rabbi who had a law degree, and another person, his name was Dr. David Pelkovitz, who was considered the Godel Hador, the psychologist in our world. He sat with me. Now, they have a more credentialed psychologist in the secular court. We have a psychologist here. You think that the psychologist in the New York State Court is more credentialed than David Pelkovitz? What do you say? No, of course not. He's from the Gedolim. Right? So what are they going to do? They're going to overturn his ruling, and they're going to have it ruled by someone. I mean, they could do it, but look, they're not looking for work. The courts have enough to do. And they see these credentials. They can give them a list of credentials. Shazam, Min Peck, you know, his CV. Ooh. So they're not going to start up with it. So that's why we have it here, even though we know, technically speaking, anybody can come and overturn it, or try to overturn it. And if the judge says yes, we're powerless. But in reality, it stays. Okay? Now, the Beis Din may consider, this is an interesting line, which is almost cut off in this edition, I feel bad about this. The Beis Din of America may consider the respective responsibilities of either or both of the parties for the end of the marriage, and I'm sorry the last line is cut off, I'll read it to you, as an additional but not exclusive factor in determining the distribution of marital property and maintenance should such a determination be authorized by the previous section. What this means is that in many New York courts, no fault, we don't be bothered. Someone could have been guilty of adultery, of any crazy sin in the world, no fault. That's not the way Beis Din works. Beis Din has to reserve for itself the right, may consider the respective responsibility. We don't have to, we're not tying our hands, but reserving that right, which in the secular forum often is not the case. Atkan Rabosai, the gist of the document, the first two pages, I'm sorry that was cut off. The last two pages, as I said, is page three, is notarization. One of our good friends, an attorney, was able to pull off the following amazing feat. In New York State, the officiating rabbi is qualified to notarize a prenuptial agreement, and they may use the following form. Believe it or not, I'm a notary for this purpose, and I've done many times, I've signed it. Okay. The fourth page is an instruction page. No, I didn't give it to everybody. You can get it online when you get home. It's instructions, a whole page of instructions, tell you what it's all about, where to keep it, and who to call in an emergency, etc., etc. Atka. Before I go into the critics, I want to ask you if you have any of your own questions before I speak about the criticisms and the shortcomings of this agreement. Yes. No problem. You take it to secular court, and it gets enforced.
Okay, so then you don't have somebody who can try to extort money from somebody.
You can try anything you want. You can try whatever you want, but this is enforceable in a secular court. It's enforceable. It's been enforced. Aside from the Maryland case, which was obviously confirmed what I wrote, in Connecticut, not long ago, someone raised a constitutional objection, church-state, and it was clear, that's what our lawyers had said 20 years ago, it's absolutely not in violation of any such clause, which was a very good piece of news. Yes?
This last point, I never heard it, the rabbi can be the notary, how do you judge who the Orthodox rabbi? Let's say you don't draw a rabbi, maybe he can say, this rabbi who notarized it is not really Orthodox enough for this.
Hold on, let me read the words before I go further. One second. It doesn't say Orthodox. The officiating rabbi takes care of that problem. And any other questions? Yeah. There are many competing halachic prenups. I didn't want to get involved in others, but since you asked the question, I'll tell you briefly. One of them is just translate the ksuba, and that solves the whole problem. I already addressed that before. It doesn't. Because if you just the ksuba, he will claim that it's her fault that the marriage broke up, and as a result, based on the Ramah and Siman Ayin, if you'd base, I'm exempt. That's one.
Besides, they don't sign the secret, they don't sign it.
No. The suggestion was to take a ksuba, write it in English, have it notarized, have it, but that won't work. Number two suggestion was something called liquidated damages for a significant sum of money. And the question is that collectible according to Jewish law? Not so simple. Another one spoke about a situation that if an individual will not come to the Beis Din appropriately, that there could be, again, specific performance, that's the word that's thrown in, with the legal consequences, which turn out to be contempt of court. Now, not being an attorney, I was told that if a person is in contempt of court, what can happen to such a person? We have three lawyers at least here. Nothing?
Jail.
That's the point. Jail. And jail is no good. Because if you throw someone into jail, that's what might be called a get me'usa, a forced get, which we haven't discussed that yet in our series. The forced get. We only mentioned it in the opening because it was making headlines at the time. Now the headlines have calmed down. Maybe next time we'll talk about if there's ever a case where you can have such a thing, at least in theory. But that's why that was inappropriate. Then, Rabbi Bleich Shalita has a whole series of suggestions which are, to my mind, complex, both in terms of because they're so complex, I don't think they're going to ever be used by a large number of population. Some of them are even halakhically, to my mind, questionable, but it's too, I can't get into those discussions. It's too complex, the intricacies. Yes?
Shlomo Zalman didn't sign on to this, right?
No, his son-in-law signed on. Son-in-law.
So why didn't he want to sign on?
You have to, now we can't ask him anymore. I don't know. Yeah.
He's 10 years son.
Sorry?
How do we record that every couple that gets married signs?
So there is an ongoing discussion in the Rabbinical Council of America, to which I belong, whether it should be mandatory that no rabbi should be allowed to perform a marriage ceremony unless the prenup is signed. I'm not so draconian. I feel that it's not for me to impose such a harsh, absolute measure, in which case a person who does any marriage without a prenup should be thrown out of the RCA. I find that that's not the way I like to operate. But it is a problem, because there are those who don't sign it. You know, every year, I speak in a school, a high school for girls in the five towns. The Rebbetzin, who was assistant principal years ago, asked me to come. And I go every year for many years already, that the women, when they're only finishing their senior year, but you know, to go to Israel, come back before you turn around, you know, what else? So it was a famous case where I got a call from such a young lady. She tells me, Rabbi, I'm getting divorced. I promised, did you sign a prenup? No. No? Weren't you there? Yeah. Why did you sign? They told me I didn't have to. So because they told her that she didn't have to, it was a bloodbath. But a bloodbath involving Rabbonim who were going at each other in the community. It was a disaster. For years of pain and anguish and I don't want to even say how bad it was. Because they didn't sign it. Now, that's in a community where the rabbis are advocating that it should be signed. There are other communities where they're not even advocating it. That's your question about what a good Israel of America has to say about it. All I know is two citations. One, from a famous rabbi, Rabbi Chaim Adovitz Rebel, who was an attorney, and he is quoted in the newspapers. I can't vouch for the accuracy of any newspapers, that's for sure. But you can call him up to find if it's accurate, that he has absolutely no objection to a properly constructed prenup. Okay? A spokesman for that same organization has recently been involved in newspapers or blogs, I don't know exactly what's what, forcefully advocating against this prenup. It's not nice to talk about such matters upon marriage. It's not romantic. So they wrote back to him, what do you think the ksuba is about? The ksuba, no one understands it. It's in Aramaic. That's why it's okay. Someone told us, just do it in Aramaic. It'll be no problem.
Rabbi?
Yes?
Has this been revised or updated over the years?
Yes.
So the different versions of this? Because people got married 5 years ago.
Yeah, there are some different versions, but the fundamental thrust of the document has been the same for 20 years. There have been a couple of additions and modifications, but it's fundamentally the same. Okay. Now, I wanted just to mention a number of possible objections, and I believe we have to address objections, because it's important to understand that there's no monopoly on wisdom in Jewish law. Okay? It's very, very important to understand that. Now, we have, as I told you before, a precedent for all of these, for the thrust of the main obligation, is found in the, I told you, in Nachlas Shiva. And as a matter of fact, the Ramah and Siman Nun and Ebenezer talks about these Tnoim. They have Tnoim, which are done for Shiduchim, and they make Knas, if you back out from the Shidduch, etc., etc. There's a whole discussion of these ins and outs. In the middle of this discussion, there is a phrase which is cited, that Machmas Kitat V'idur Yomad Kitakonas Shum. If it's a fight or an Idur. What does one translate Idur? What's the translate Idur? No, it's Ayin Yud Dalad Vav Resh. Anybody? Who knows Hebrew here? Ne'edar. What does Ne'edar mean? No, not Ne'edar. Ne'edar with an Ayin. Na'adar.
Missing.
Missing. The Ne'edarim. Missing that? Ne'edarim. It's a euphemism for death. Either means death. A person dies, he's missing. You don't write that visa. Death. Which means that there was a takana of Shum, which goes back to Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam was not only called Rabbeinu Tam because of Yaakov Ishtam, his name was Tam, but also because it says in the pasuk, V'tam l'rik kochachem. And the Chazal say a person who makes a fortune of money, and he saves it for the dowry for his daughter. He gives it for his daughter as a dowry, and the daughter dies. All the money goes to the son-in-law, who's not going to marry somebody else and have kids from somebody else, and all his money's going to be out of his family. V'tam l'rik kochachem. So Rabbeinu Tam ordained, this is a Tosfos in Ksubos, that if within a year there's a death, the money goes back to the father. Nebuchadnezzar lost the daughter, he should lose all his money too. And if the second year he gets half back, that's mach idur. What's katat? What is katat? No one knows what it is. It means exactly this. It means exactly this. Katat means what I just told you before. Katat means that if there's a fight, he will give her 10 zehuvim every month, as long as they're not living together. That is exactly the katat that is described in the classical tanoim. The classical tanoim have that in them. Now today's tanoim, we write tanoim these days at a wedding where Moshe took everything out of it. Doesn't say anything. It's platitudes. Doesn't say anything. But the original tanoim had that line in them. The Chassidim is still assigning them. That's what it says in Nachal Shiva. Machmas idur uktat yomad kitakon ashur. This seems to be a perfect precedent for our prenup. However, full disclosure, there were those who claimed, though, that yes, it's true that when Takana Shum was ordained in Shum, what's Shum stand for? Shvarev Amarza Magensa, as well as in later years, it became accepted by everybody. I'm reading to you what the Ansar de Shulchan Aruch. Because in Poland, it was de rigueur. Lefizeh af imlo nichta b'tznoim. Mashenogu lichto b'tznoim ach was idu uktat. Yomek atakon ashum. It's ke'ilu nichtav. Minik poshut. They accepted atakon ashum no matter what. So writes the Chelkos Mechokek. Even if it's not, if it's, Beishmul quotes it. No matter what. So the argument is made, this goes through the power of Hefker Bezdin Hefker. Because the organized communities in Europe, they had the power to tax and to assess and to expropriate money, do whatever they want. But today's world, where that power no longer exists, then it runs afoul of the problem of Asmachta. Asmachta is a contingency obligation. I don't think it's true for the following reason. If you look in the Pisrei Tshuva, it's in Simen Nun Gimel, Sifkaton Yud Gimel, it says, Yom HaTakana Shum, Nachla Shiva Simetes. He didn't find that. We didn't know exactly what it was, the whole discussion. And there it says that in Poland, it's automatic. But in Ashkenaz, no, I never heard of this minhag. That means that in Ashkenaz, presumably, it's not an automatic. So if it's not an automatic, presumably it's not based on expropriation of the Bezdin and Ashkenaz. It's based on the person's own acceptance of the obligation. If it's there, it's there. If it's not there, it's not there. So therefore, it seems to me from Ashkenaz we see that there's an ability to accept this obligation, and it's not an Asmachta. Now, when I came back from that barnstorm tour that way back in 1992 in Eretz Yisrael, I received signatures in this country both from Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz and from Rabbi Libis Zichron LeRoch. Rabbi Libis was a Rav in Bronx and in Borough Park. Okay. And then I went to some of my friends in Brooklyn to see if I could make some headway with them. And I went to the two rabbis, Cohen, the famous Gedolim, Rabbi David Cohen, Rabbi Feivel Cohen. They both told me they see no halakhic objection to it as such, but NIMBY, not in my backyard. It's not gonna happen with us. It's just not going to happen. I don't understand it, because there's been so much blood both before and after in that community. Blood. It's going on right now. I mentioned the first week I was here, but what happened in the New York Post. We know where that's coming from, which part of the community it's coming from. Why? If there'd be a prenup, it's unlikely that would happen. I can't say, maybe, you never know. Unlikely. Probably would have said, listen, I'm going to pay $150 a day. It's ridiculous. Like, yeah, I'd rather just give her a get. So there were no formal objections. I was asked to go to Rabbi Yashiv about it, which I did. And he sent me to his assistant, Rabbi Morgenstern. And he expressed a number of objections. One was, and this was printed by Rabbi Gartner in that original article in 1988, Rabbi Yashiv was afraid that the chassan will not know what he's signing. Won't know what he's signing. I don't understand the objection too much, because if you sign something and you claim you don't know what you're signing, so you shouldn't have signed it. I don't know. He says, I'm Oretz Shabolaga. He says, Lohevin Masha Kosa Betunoyim, Eino Neman. You're not believed. You're not believed. They presume that if you sign something, you know what you signed. That's objection number one. Objection number two, he thought we're going to go to secular court, but that's just was a mistake of fact. Objection three, I don't understand either. Was going to give a get where otherwise he wouldn't have. Well, that's exactly the point. I don't understand what the. But objection number four is the most serious one. Maybe the question of asmachta. I told you before, an asmachta is a contingency obligation, which in certain circumstances can be considered invalid. If it's invalid, then the man is given the get to avoid an obligation to pay, which is invalid. That can have a negative impact on the get itself. Now, Rabbi Yosher did not say that to me, and I think I know why. Rabbi Yosher, as you know, was a great goyin and tzaddik. He was not afraid to express his opinions. If he thought that this was really no good, I think he would have certainly said so. He didn't. He didn't endorse it. He didn't condemn it. Even though he knew full well about it. I was there with him twice about it. I think the reason why. The reason why he thinks it's an asmachta, I also found. It's written in his Trivus. He says, according to the Rambam's opinion, an obligation, which is contingency, even if you have a kinyan me'achshav v'bezen choshev, is still an asmachta. Little me, I think, he's 100% right. And according to the Rambam, this would be an asmachta. I'm saying it up front. However, in my opinion, we don't pass like the Rambam. Not the Ramah, not the Shulchan Aruch. They don't accept the Rambam. So the fact that there's a Rambam out there, that shouldn't concern us. As a matter of fact, Rav Chaim Vilcon himself has a whole book called Midor Lador, which is about inheritance. And the entire book is based on the assumption that such a obligation is binding. I'll tell you a story. One final story before I come to the...
Why can't you just write the word like in Iksuba, below Kiyasma?
That doesn't help. It's like Nishkan Shabbos Gerit. That doesn't help. There was a case that happened in 1995. I have the papers still to prove it. A young man from Yeshiva of Far Rockaway was becoming married to a young lady from Riverdale who belonged to the Hebrew Institute. How that should have happened, I don't know. I hope they're happily married together. I know it's already 18 years later. I don't understand, but it happened. And Rabbi Weiss told the Kala, I'm not letting you go to the chuppah without a prenup. I got a call from Rabbi Kaufman, presently the Rosh Yeshiva of Waterbury. Then he was assistant to Rabbi Peer. He's now mechutin with the Cohens of Riverdale. He is a son-in-law of Rabbi Chaim Vilcon. Those were at that wedding. Rabbi Chaim Vilcon was, of course, there. And what does he do now? I said, what's wrong? Well, my shver said there may be some problems. I said, I was by your shver 3 years ago. 2 years ago, he didn't have any problems. Well, Rabbi Yashiv, because you're... So I wrote a piece of paper to him, and I faxed him. I have the original. I wrote all these obligations to him. And after he saw all them, he said, it's okay, you can do it. Not that he's endorsing it for every single case, but in that case, he just let you know that a Father Cohen is considered the Pesach in Brooklyn, said, it's all right. I wish he would say everyone should do it, but at least he said, in that particular case, it was okay. Now, I think I know why Rabbi Yashiv was not more, didn't have a stronger objection. I'll end with this. There's another tshuva of Rabbi Yashiv. It's the following question. It bothered me for years. Every ksuba is an asmachta. Every ksuba is in a contingency obligation. If the man dies before her or divorces her, he has to give her money. Every single ksuba should be no good, except for the minimum which is required by halacha. That's the question. The answer is he gives, Rabbi Yashiv, is, of course, from Sefer Erech Shai. The Gemara is Masech to Ksubas, and Masech to Kiddushin. Kama tanosan lebincha. Kama tanosan lebitcha. The Mechutonim. How much are you giving? What are you putting into this kitty? Omdu v'kitshu. There's a dvarim ha'niknim ba'amira. No need for any kinyan. Because since they're so desires of having this marriage take place, no kinyan is required. No kinyan is required, so asmachta presents no problem. Asmachta undermines the kinyan. There is no kinyan required. That's why I believe Rabbi Yosha has no objection to it deep down, because this is a prenuptial. So therefore, even if it is an asmachta, it's not a problem. That's my theory. I can't prove it. Well, I'm sorry for going a little bit late today. We started late. I went a little bit late. I apologize. Mishnah, the next should be in 2 weeks. I might talk about a forced get, but if you have a different topic you want me to talk about in this series, please let me know now, and I will change my plans. Anyone have any particular... Yes?
No, I have
a question. Let's go off the record. Okay. And once we're off the record, these tapes are available on the Young Israel of Riverdale website, which many of you don't even know about. It exists. I went to look today to see if it exists. It does exist. So please avail yourself of those.